NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. How is AI reshaping the way the U.S. goes to war? The impact of the tech on the Iran conflict. And diesel prices are spiking, and that will affect the cost of everything from food to consumer goods. Plus, armadillos are on the march in North Carolina. The odd little mammals may do some good.
In addition to the armadillo having all these other nicknames, such as Hoover Hog, Texas Turkey, Little Armored One, Ecosystem Engineer might be yet another nickname for the armadillo.
It's Sunday, March 15th. News is next.
For KAXE News, I'm Megan Buffington with the Up North Report. A judge has denied a motion to dismiss charges filed last year against a correctional nursing director following the death of a man in Beltrami County jail custody. Chelsea Perkins brings us the update.
27-year-old Hardell Sherrell died in September 2018, 2 days after serious symptoms resulted in a hospital visit. The doctor who discharged him wrote instructions listing several symptoms that should have prompted Sherrell to seek additional immediate care. Instead, according to the criminal complaint, Sherrell received very little care and his health rapidly deteriorated. Michelle Scroke was the nurse in charge at the Beltrami County Jail when Sherrell died. Scroke was also the director of nursing for Mend Correctional Care. She was responsible for reviewing and approving the company's care policies and overseeing all its nurses across multiple jails. The 38-year-old faces three felonies for manslaughter and criminal neglect. Scroke's defense sought dismissal, arguing that her conduct did not deviate from the lawfully permissible standard. In a denial order filed Thursday, Beltrami County Judge Janine Brand says the state attorney general's office showed sufficient probable cause to allow the case to move forward. Prosecutors submitted more than 3,000 pages of documents and 2 hours of video footage. Brand writes that despite knowing Sherrell was just in the hospital, Scroke never took his vitals, ignored him for hours at a time, and yelled at him that he was, quote, faking it. When Scroke left the day Sherrell died, evidence shows she knew he had lost control of his bladder, his face was drooping, he had difficulty swallowing, couldn't stand, and was becoming weaker. His cause of death was pneumonia and brain swelling, likely complications of the autoimmune disease Guillain-Barré syndrome. A plea hearing in the case is set for 10 a.m. on Monday. Chelsea Perkins, KAXE News.
Representative Pete Stauber is proposing legislation aimed at preventing fraud in child care assistance programs. The Republican introduced the bill Thursday, which he called the Stop Fraud by Somalia Act. A bill with the same name was introduced by Senate Republicans in January. Stauber says widespread child care fraud in Minnesota was primarily perpetrated by Somalis. In a news release touting the legislation, Stauber says the bill would bar people convicted of fraud from the Child Care Assistance Program for life, require states to reimburse the federal government for fraudulently obtained funds, and allow non-citizens to be deported for committing fraud. The Council on American Islamic Relations Minnesota condemned the legislation, calling the bill's name and framing discriminatory and deeply irresponsible. The organization says the rhetoric contributes to harmful stereotypes and that fraud is a crime by individuals, not an entire community. The whirlwind of fraud concerns in Minnesota has been primarily driven by providers billing for services that weren't provided. The fraud was enabled by a long-documented lack of oversight in the state's largely federally funded Department of Human Services programs, including child care assistance. Stauber invited right-wing influencer Nick Shirley to the State of the Union last month. A video by Shirley went viral in December and brought national attention to Minnesota. In it, he visited 10 Minneapolis daycares run by Somali residents that he said were not caring for children and were misappropriating funds. The Minnesota Star Tribune found children inside four of the daycares and had previously reported on issues with the assistance program. Many northern Minnesota school boards could soon be a little smaller. A new bill in the state legislature would allow districts with fewer than 1,000 students to switch to a 5-member board with voter approval. Roughly 70% of rural northern Minnesota school districts would be eligible for the reduction. Under state law, school boards must have 6 members unless voters approve adding a 7th.
This structure does not reflect the realities facing Minnesota's smallest districts, particularly in rural areas where they may not have enough candidates to fill all 6 seats.
DFL Senator Grant Hochschild of Hermantown presented the bill to the Education Policy Committee Monday. Many school board races are uncontested, and sometimes no one runs at all. When that happens, the school board has to appoint someone to fill the vacancy.
In fact, our current board chair in Cook County was appointed and then ran for re-election and is still there.
Cook County Superintendent Chris Lindholm testified in support of the bill. The committee laid the bill over for inclusion in an omnibus package. That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Megan Buffington, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is sponsored by Woodland Bank, dedicated to serving local businesses, families, and nonprofits in our area since 1920. You can find more information online at woodland.bank.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. The U.S.-Israeli war with Iran is now into its third week, and the human toll is adding up. At least 1,300 people have been killed in Iran, according to officials there. Among that number, Iran's health ministry says are more than 400 women and children. 13 U.S. service members are dead. So the stakes are high. And in this war, the U.S. has employed some of the most advanced military technology ever used in an active war zone, much of it powered by artificial intelligence. Lauren Kahn is a senior research analyst for Georgetown University's Center for Security and Emerging Technology, and she joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So we're seeing, you know, reports like the earlier strike on an elementary school and a strike on low-income housing, as reported by Iranian state media this morning. So there's a human toll, and we don't know how these strikes happened. But let's get to the big picture of just how extensively AI is being used in this war right now.
Absolutely. I think it's important to think about, we are 4 years out now from the war in Ukraine, and the United States is clearly internalizing some of the lessons that we've seen there, that being the first real drone war, the first real AI war that we've seen. And so now we're seeing artificial intelligence being used across the gamut, things from natural language processing, large language models, computer vision models, different things to help with everything from decision support to autonomy and systems. So we're really seeing it across the board.
So when you say decision support, autonomy of systems, for the average listener, what does that mean? Decisions on where to strike, who to strike, how to set up logistics? Is that what you're talking about?
Everything from boardroom to battlefield, right? We're talking about logistics, things like maintenance. When do we need to update a plane right beforehand using data fusion to bring sources together from different sensors and shooters from really everywhere? So it is used on to enable autonomous systems, things like drones in part to make them more capable of, you know, traveling to a location by themselves, or things, again, like where you're seeing compiling information to get information from disparate systems into the hands of the warfighter.
Is artificial intelligence making decisions about who lives and who dies?
Not at this moment, no.
And so, how do we know that?
Well, we know that in terms of how that it's integrated, right? We have to eventually come to a point where we're deciding what are the ranges and where are the locations that AI should not be used. Right now, I think what's more insidious is that it's being integrated in places where, you know, it's hard to tell in some places, where this, we're having this blurring of, to your point exactly, of where the AI starts and where the AI stops. We need to be really sensitive about where we integrate it and what places are off limits. I think for a good example, we can all agree that maybe logistics is a really kind of easy one, or disaster relief is a really easy one. There have been agreements for between states from the United States and China, for example, that, you know, we don't want any AI over nuclear decision making. So there's a tiered sort of framework we can look at this, a slide sliding scale of where AI should be integrated and not.
But does it require an amount of trusting the government that the government is not using artificial intelligence to, you know, have a drone go out there and drop somewhere without the human intervention or the human looking and saying, hey, hey, this might not be the right space?
Yeah, absolutely. Humans are always responsible over the use of force. That is entirely compliant with international humanitarian law. And there is no one system that is or is not compliant. It's how it's employed and how it's used. And so we have to look at the policies that are in place. The United States has had a policy, for example, on lethal autonomous weapon systems and autonomous weapon systems from 2013 about review of when a system might come into play. So we don't know how that's happened yet, but they are things that they are thinking about. So that will be definitely a problem down the line.
So what do you make of the feud between AI company Anthropic and the Pentagon? Anthropic says it won't allow its Claude technology to be used in fully autonomous weapons.
Right. I think actually what's interesting about that kind of debate is that it's the difference between Anthropic and the Pentagon wasn't very large, right? The Pentagon said we wanted to use it for legal applications that we're allowed to use it in, and Anthropic wanted a specific carve-out for autonomous systems, you know, based on their red line, but has used it in the past and is using it in this current conflict. And so I think it was really came down to that, to your point, a breakdown of trust rather than any real application of the technology being used today.
That's Lauren Kahn with the Center for Security and Emerging Technology. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Voters in Illinois head to the polls this Tuesday for primary elections. For Democrats, the vote in this reliably blue state comes as many within the base are demanding change, with some even calling for a new generation of leaders. NPR political reporter reporter Elena Moore traveled to one Chicago area district to see how those calls are resonating with candidates.
It's Saturday morning, and a bunch of local union members file into a small campaign office in Evanston, Illinois. They prep for a day of canvassing. There's coffee and donuts. It's a traditional campaign scene.
I'm the mayor. If you're not from here, welcome to Evanston.
Folks are here to support Daniel Biss, mayor of this small city north of Chicago. It's part of a district that's had the same member of Congress for the last 27 years, Democrat Jan Schakowsky. The 81-year-old is retiring, and the top candidates vying to replace her span three generations, from Gen X and millennials to Gen Z. So voters have to decide what a new era of Democratic leadership here should look like. Schakowsky is hoping to pass the torch to Biss, a 48-year-old Gen Xer.
The balance of power is shifting from workers to corporations. We got to blow that up, and I'm going to go to Congress and be a part of blowing that up.
Recent polls show Biss leading in a field of more than a dozen Democrats.
There's nobody else who's done both things that I think we need right now. Fought and won inside of government and fought and won out on the streets. And I just don't think we can afford to compromise on either of those two things.
30-year-old supporter Sierra Claiborne showed up to canvass.
I like his idea of like progressive change in moderation as somebody that is not the biggest fan of drastic change instantly.
Biss has establishment support, though he also says Democrats need to fight harder against President Trump's agenda and push harder for solutions to high costs. But in this district, where the primary is more competitive than the general, policies aren't what's dividing the field. Instead, it's over how much they want to scrap party norms, both in office and on the campaign trail. 10 minutes away, on the north side of Chicago, 26-year-old first-time candidate Kat Abagazale is knitting a hat for one of her supporters.
So we had a live stream where we promised anyone who donated, like, above X amount, I would make them a hat, and this is the last hat that I have to finish.
The campaign hosts a weekly knitting circle where supporters can come by the office and talk politics.
Bipartisanship is negotiating different approaches to a similar goal. That goal should be everyone can afford housing, groceries, and healthcare with money left over to save and spend. But we can't just look at compromise as getting your hand cut off and being grateful they left you your pinky.
Abagazale has a background as a progressive researcher and commentator. She's faced concerns about her knowledge of the area, having only moved to Chicago in 2024. But she's also one of the most watched candidates in this race, with a large online presence and a non-traditional ground game. The campaign phone banks and canvases, but they also hold events like this one. As Abu-Ghazaleh knits, she tells the group what she thinks is wrong with her party.
The Democratic Party has been terrified of the idea of progressive populism because it means risking power. It means not being able to have a stranglehold on donors and on re-elections.
It's part of a broader anti-establishment message energizing many Democrats. And though folks in this district say age won't decide their vote, some younger supporters admit they do share generational experiences, especially with financial concerns. Many also worry about the role of special interest groups in politics. Abu-Ghazaleh has criticized Democrats for accepting money from super PACs and pro-Israel lobbying groups like AIPAC. Those are top issues for Jim Kress. He's in his late 30s and actually voted for BIS when he ran for governor a few years ago. But now he's backing Abu-Ghazaleh.
He's just like your typical neoliberal Democratic establishment that I'm tired of seeing and tired of giving my vote to. So Kat pretty much hit the nail on the head when she said the people you vote for should be working for you, not the other way around.
BIS has sworn off donations from AIPAC, but it's a fight that's captured attention in this race.
This is a yellow line train to Dempster, Skokie.
28-year-old Bushra Amiwala has struggled to break through in the race. But looking out the window, she still sees a path to victory.
I literally have seen 3 different Bushra yard signs that I just happen to see, and it's because we're in home base right now.
At 21, she was one of the first members of Gen Z elected to office, serving on her local school board. Now, Amiwala wants to represent her hometown in Congress. But the crowded field is a challenge.
It can be really confusing and difficult to navigate the myriad of options we have, but that's why this election matters so much.
It's districts like these, she says, where progressive leaders can push for ambitious policy. So, at a moment when some longtime Democrats are stepping aside, who voters elect in solid blue seats like this one could offer a glimpse into the party's future. Elena Moore, NPR News, Chicago.
You're listening to NPR News.
You are tuned in to Weekend Edition this Sunday morning here on KAXE KBXE, People Powered Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. Get a head start on spring cleaning with KXE's Cars program. Your unwanted vehicle will be towed away for free, and the proceeds fuel all your favorite programs on KXE KBXE. It's quick, easy, and there's no cost to you. Visit kaxe.org/cars to get your car donation started, or call Heather at 218-326-1234 for more info. After Dark is our late-night Saturday showcase of a variety of musical styles outside our normal KAXE mix. Tune in after Green Cheese at 9 p.m. to hear punk, hip-hop, electronic, metal-themed shows, and more. Essentia Health and the Virginia Fire Department offer free car seat inspections on the second Tuesday of each month from 4 to 6 at the Virginia Public Library Safety Building on 2nd Avenue South. Inspections are done on a first-come, first-served basis.
I'm Windsor Johnston with these headlines. The Trump administration says U.S. military operations against Iran have significantly weakened the country's military strength. The White House says American strikes have pushed Iran's land and naval capabilities to the brink. Additional drone and missile attacks are being reported across parts of the Gulf region as tensions continue to rise. Iran has also called for evacuations at 3 major ports in the United Arab Emirates. Nearly 90,000 people in Hawaii are still without electricity after a powerful storm moved across the islands. The severe weather damaged power equipment and left tens of thousands of homes and businesses in the dark. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Made in Cookware. Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs for chefs and designed for restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at madeincookware.com. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is Week in Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. The war with Iran has brought the Strait of Hormuz, where a fifth of the world oil passes through, close to a standstill. For U.S. consumers, that means higher gas prices, and that includes diesel, the fuel that powers many of the industries that we rely on for food and transportation. To help us understand the implications, we turn to Patrick DeHaan. He's the head of the petroleum analysis for Gas Buddy. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So how important is diesel to our economy? What are some of the industries most affected by these rising prices?
Well, certainly, as you mentioned, diesel is the fuel that powers the U.S. economy from construction to agriculture, from logistics and everything in between. It's really the fuel that gets the products to the market that you and I bring home on a daily basis. And we've seen diesel flourishing. In fact, looking at data this morning, 45 of the nation's 50 states are seeing average diesel prices up over a dollar a gallon in the last 4 weeks, with nearly half of them up even $1.30 or more.
Oh, wow. I mean, so the last time diesel prices were this high was in 2022, and that was after the Russian invasion of Ukraine. So what lessons did you take away from that price spike?
Well, that was certainly a very rare spike induced by, as you mentioned, Russia's invasion of Ukraine. But at the same time, the U.S. economy reopening, really the global economy reopening after the U.S. economy did as well. And we saw a tremendous spike in demand as consumers started to consume more and get outside. And this situation here in 2026 is much different, that this is completely focused on the supply side. Demand has been pretty consistent, but it's a major supply disruption. As you mentioned there, the Strait of Hormuz carrying about 20% of the daily flow of oil, and that's just insurmountable to overcome. That has certainly impacted hundreds of millions of barrels now, sending the price of oil up and trickling down to the gas pump, diesel prices, and jet fuel being extremely impacted as well.
So, you know, back in 2022, how were consumer prices for things like food and transportation affected?
Well, obviously, the 2022 situation induced a significant level of inflation as fuel prices skyrocketed. Russia, at the same time, was a major producer of agriculture, and that caused a lot of commodity, corn, wheat, soybean prices to go up as well. So this time around, it's more focused on the fuel aspect, oil, chemicals, petrochemicals all being blocked, fertilizers being blocked as well. And that's going to create the collateral damage, not only diesel prices going up, but a lot of the chemicals farmers need to get the food to market are also being impacted. And so this could start another swing back the other way. Inflation has been lessening in recent months, and this certainly could swing the pendulum back in the other direction.
The Trump administration has given a lot of mixed messages on when this war could end. If there continue to be transit issues with the Strait of Hormuz, to put it lightly, just how high could prices get?
Well, we don't really know that. The market doesn't have a good answer, and some have thrown out estimates of $150 to $200 a barrel, but economics teaches us that oil will continue going up until demand falls down to the realistic amount that the market can supply, which right now is a gaping 20 million barrel a day hole. There are some countries in the Middle East now trying to make some sort of contingency plan, Saudi Arabia using its east-west pipeline. But all in all, oil prices could continue to rise well beyond $100.
So if the Strait of Hormuz were to reopen to oil traffic, how quickly would the price of oil fall back down? And then how quickly would that translate at the pump?
Well, oil could start to plummet if that happened in just a matter of 24 to 48 hours. And it likely would take a few days beyond that for consumers to start feeling relief And it could at this point take at least a month or beyond that for consumers to see noticeable and full decreases at the pump, with decreases of maybe a penny or two a day.
That's Patrick DeHaan, head of petroleum analysis for Gas Buddy. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
36,000 municipalities across France, from major cities to tiny hamlets, will choose their mayor today in a two-round election. French voters are more fragmented than ever, with the largest voting blocks on the extremes. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports the election could be a harbinger for next year's presidential race.
At a street market in Paris's well-heeled 7th arrondissement, retiree Edith Daubert says the city has been ruined by 25 years of leftist green rule. She says the focus on evicting cars and creating bike lanes hurt businesses, and the list goes on.
Paris is really falling down. It's really dirty, insecurity.
She complains about crime and a proliferation of public housing that she says chased families from the city. Daubert is counting on right-wing candidate Sarah Knafo, who's campaigning here today, to take Paris back.
So how are things going?
Very good. Thanks.
I ask Sarah Knafo about her slogan, a happy city.
It means a city where, first off, you can find housing, and it means a safe city, and a city where you want to start a family, a city that doesn't take all your money in taxes.
The 32-year-old studied at LENA, the French equivalent of Harvard. She's a first-time candidate for the anti-immigration party Reconquête, and she's soaring in the polls. Abraham Benfredj is a supporter.
Nothing in the party is racist, but we are for the assimilation. What it means is that wherever you come from, as soon as you decide to become like a French citizen, to behave like a French, to love the flag and what we do, you can be like us.
These affluent Parisians say the mainstream right betrayed voters, but they want nothing to do with Marine Le Pen's working-class far-right party either. They say it rejects free market principles. Political analyst Jean-Yves Camus says France's two far-right movements differ on immigration, where Reconquête takes a harder line, and the economy, where Le Pen's Rassemblement National embraces more socialist policies.
The Rassemblement National mostly appeals to the lower class, to the working class. It also appeals to a lot of disgruntled people.
People who live in former factory towns. Outside of affluent Paris, Le Pen's party is surging and poised to take three major southern cities, Nice, Marseille, and Toulon, as well as smaller towns in between. Camus.
At the end of it, when you win several small cities, you control an entire area.
The far left is hoping to take a swath of towns in the north, but it's been damaged by the behavior of its controversial leader, Jean-Luc Mélenchon.
De l'affaire Epstein. Ah, je voulais dire Epstein!
At a rally in February, the conspiracy-minded Mélenchon implied that the media's pronunciation of Jeffrey Epstein's name pointed to some sort of plot. Camus says his comments were seen as anti-Semitic.
Mélenchon has really gone too far recently.
France's large Jewish community has flocked to Reconquête and Knafo. Camus says Jews see it as the only party that will protect them. Still, the Socialist Green Coalition is leading the Paris race, with the mainstream conservative candidate in close second.
Aujourd'hui, les Parisiennes et les Parisiens sont victimes d'une explosion de la délinquance.
Polls show conservative Rachida Dati, speaking here on TV, would win if she allies with Knafo's Reconquête for the runoff March 22nd. Dati has so far refused, but critics say for the first time ever, the far right could be the kingmaker in the Paris mayoral race. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
In Hollywood, the red carpet is out. The Oscars are tonight. Critics have been locking in, poring over the list of nominees, and making predictions. NPR critic Aisha Harris is here with hers. Hi, Aisha.
Hey, Aisha. Thanks for having me.
So first, Best Picture, two front runners. A lot of people are pulling for Sinners.
I don't believe in magic. Ghosts, demons. just power.
And a lot of other people are pulling for one battle after another.
Steve Lockjaw just attacked my home, and I cannot remember, for the life of my only child, the answer to your question.
Maybe you should have studied the rebellion text a little harder.
Is this really a toss-up, or does one of these movies have this locked in?
I really do feel like this could be a toss-up. I do think since the campaign began, award season began, these two have been sort of at the forefront of the entire race. But I do think One Battle After Another kind of has the edge. I think in part because Hollywood loves to honor veteran filmmakers who have yet to win the big prizes. And Paul Thomas Anderson, who directed One Battle After Another, he has been in this game for decades now. He's a director's director. So I think all of that goodwill is going to go a long way to, you know, One Battle probably taking the top prize and Paul Thomas Anderson also maybe getting best director as well.
So we know it's ranked choice voting for Best Picture. Do you have a dark horse candidate?
The only one I would say that could, you know, come up from behind unexpectedly is maybe Hamnet, Chloe Zhao's Hamnet. You know, she's already won previously Best Picture for Nomadland. I also think it's a very heavy movie. It's a movie that has, when I saw it at the theaters, people were bawling and sniffling because they were so just overcome with emotion from that movie. And I can see that being one that voters keep in the back of their minds. And perhaps even if it's not necessarily number one at the top of their ballots, there's a chance that it could slip in anyway if enough people put it at number two or three, for sure.
So let's talk about the acting prizes. There's been a bit of controversy about Timothée Chalamet's thoughts on ballet and opera. Do you think he's still in contention?
Yeah. I mean, look, Timmy has been running a campaign that is not too dissimilar from his character in Marty Supreme, which he is nominated for. He's very, very open about his desire to win. Some people have been rubbed the wrong way by this, but I do think he's still going to get it. Now, there's been a lot of buzz about his comments about ballet and opera. Here's a clip, actually, from that Variety and CNN town hall that was at the end of February with Matthew McConaughey.
I don't want to be working in ballet or opera or, you know, things where it's like, hey, keep this thing alive, even though no one cares about this anymore. All respect to the ballet and opera people out there. I just lost 14 cents in viewership. But damn, I just took shots for no reason.
That's not a shot. I hear what you're saying.
Yeah. I mean, look, that doesn't sound great. But also, the statement didn't really grab any steam until after voting for the awards already ended. So I don't know how much that will play into it, if at all. I'm pulling for Michael B. Jordan, who's nominated for playing a set of twins and sinners. I think it's a fantastic role. It's his best performance to date. But overall, this is a really stacked category. The other nominees include Leonardo DiCaprio in One Battle After Another. You've got Ethan Hawke in Blue Moon and Wagner Moura in The Secret Agent. So really any of them possibly could win, but I'm still putting my money on Timmy.
How about Best Actress? Remind us of the nominees on this one.
Yeah, you have Jessie Buckley in Hamnet, Rose Byrne in If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You, Kate Hudson for Song Song Blue, Renata Reinsve for Sentimental Value, and Emma Stone for Begonia.
And of those, who is your pick?
So I'm going to say that Jessie Buckley is probably going to win for Hamnet. She seems to be the front runner right now. And that's also a movie that I think has appealed to a lot of people in terms of parenthood and tugging at the heartstrings. It's a very emotional and big performance. But I really, really want Renata Reinsve to win for Sentimental Value. I just think that movie overall is far better. And she is so, so good in it. And I would love to see that happen.
That's Aisha Harris. She hosts NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast. You can subscribe to their newsletter at npr.org/newsletters, and you can keep track of the Oscar winners tonight at npr.org. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Bath County, Kentucky celebrated a historic occurrence earlier this month, the meat shower of 1876. That's when pieces of meat mysteriously fell from the sky onto a farm. Sherry Lawson of member station WEKU was at the festivities.
At the Bath County History Museum in rural Kentucky, dozens of people crowd around Kurt Godey. He's a professor at Transylvania University in Lexington.
We believe it's a sample from the meat ran of 1876.
He's holding a glass jar with the meat sample in a clear liquid. Godey has been fascinated with the meat shower for over 20 years.
And the pieces that rained in that storm ranged from the size of a hailstone to the size of Rebecca Crouch's hand.
Rebecca Crouch is the woman who witnessed the meat shower 150 years ago. She was outside making soap on her Bath County farm when pieces of what appeared to be raw meat rained on her under cloudless skies. In line to see the meat is Andrew Cruzy. He has a cabin in eastern Kentucky and has heard the meat shower story for years.
It's one of those things that you hear about and you assume it's kind of urban legend, but it's actually, there's a piece of it.
Some, like Sasha Reinhardt, are having their picture taken with the jar of meat. She believes she's a descendant of the Crouch family who experienced the meat rain.
It's definitely part of our oral tradition. Of course, you know, Appalachia is really big on storytelling, oral tradition, and this was always a favorite.
150 years ago, the story was heavily publicized in the New York Times and in scientific journals. There were several theories about what it was and why meat fell out of the sky. Theories ranged from it being a sign from God to a hoax, but Godey says the most accepted theory is that the meat was vulture vomit.
The idea ultimately there is that a flock of vultures was flying high enough above the farm that when Rebecca Crouch was hit with the meat, she looked up, she couldn't see them, and the whole flock disgorged at the same time.
He says they tested the meat in the university's gene sequencer.
Ultimately, the strands were not long enough to be completely conclusive, so we don't know exactly what it was, but we do know that it's closest to a goat.
It was one of those things as a child growing up here in Bath County that you learned it from your parents.
That's Ian Corbin, who grew up here.
We even had like a week in school where you had your local history of Bath County and you learned about it.
Now he has organized a festival around the event. He orchestrates meat-themed games in the town square, like a meatball toss and a bologna throw, where a thick piece of bologna is hurled like a frisbee.
Okay, all right. One, two, three, throw! Go!
Vendors line the streets and sell things like T-shirts and mystery meat chili. At the town's library, author McSullivan reads his meat rain book to the kids.
Sometimes strange things happen.
Janie Rice's brother brought her two kids to the library to hear the story. She says she heard it from her father, who heard it from his father.
I think it's just a wonderful thing that this small community has decided to take what was a very strange occurrence and make it into something that the entire community can get behind and support.
At the end of the festival, hundreds of people stand around a white split rail fence near a field. A Cessna airplane flies over the area. 1,876 individually wrapped pieces of beef jerky spill out of the window.
There we go.
That's the work of Kurt Godey and his team. Thanks to them, a meat shower has rained in Bath County for the second time in 150 years. For NPR News, I'm Sherry Lawson in Bath County, Kentucky.
This is NPR News.
You are tuned in to Weekend Edition this Sunday morning here on KAXE, KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingel. We receive support from the Bagley Area Arts Collaborative, offering workshops in March. Porch Sign Workshop, March 21st from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., held at the Bagley Public Library, and Monthly Children's Art Series, March 21st from 10 a.m. to noon at 9 Central Street West in Bagley. More information and registration at bagleyarts.org or on Facebook. Watermark Arts Center has their first Poetry Slam of the year, Thursday, March 26th at Fozzie's Barbecue in Bemidji. Music begins at 6 with poetry at 7. Contact Watermark if you'd like to reserve a spot ahead of time. Find rules and more information at watermarkartscenter.org. United Way of 1,000 Lakes hosts a meet and greet Wednesday, March 25th from 4 to 6 at Rapids Brewing Company in Grand Rapids. It's an opportunity to meet board members and learn how you can play a role in guiding the United Way's impact.
I'm Windsor Johnston with these headlines. Arab Gulf states are reporting new missile and drone strikes after Iran threatened to expand its military campaign. The conflict in the Middle East is now entering its third week with no signs of easing. Top U.S. and Chinese economic officials are opening a new round of talks in Paris today. A Treasury Department official says the discussions come ahead of a summit between President Trump and Chinese leader Xi Jinping later this month. The Academy Awards will be handed out tonight in Los Angeles. The film One Battle After Another has dominated the award season and is widely expected to win several top prizes. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Bayer. Bayer is dedicated to delivering breakthroughs that save lives and feed the world using the scientific process. Learn more at sciencedelivers.com. From the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, at macfound.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. There's yin and yang, night and day. And when it comes to global weather, the cyclical weather patterns of La Nina and El Nino. A new federal forecast says El Nino is likely to arrive this summer. It makes the earth hotter. Rebecca Hersher from NPR's Climate Desk is here to talk about this forecast. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi.
So, El Nino is coming. Do we have an expected date?
Oh, I wish we did. We don't have, like, an exact date, but it will probably be sometime between June and August. I called up Emily Becker about this. She's a researcher at the University of Miami who helps put together the federal forecast.
Looks like about a 62% chance that El Nino will develop over the summer.
And then it will probably persist like into next year.
Now, what will that mean for people here in the U.S.?
Well, El Nino has lots of different weather effects all across the country and around the world. There are a couple that are really notable that we usually see here in the U.S. One is more rain in some parts of the country. And here's how Emily Becker explains that phenomenon.
El Nino tends to shift the jet stream in such a way that it steers storms and precipitation across the southern tier of the U.S. in the winter.
So that can be good news for areas like the Southwest that are dealing with really serious drought. More rain can obviously help refill reservoirs. It can also erase the conditions that lead to really bad wildfires. Although the drought in the Southwest right now, it's so bad that 1 year of wetter weather would not be enough to fix it. That's according to a new analysis by the National Integrated Drought Information System.
Okay, so some good news for the Southwest, potentially. But what about other parts of the country?
Well, there's also potentially good news for the East and Gulf coasts because El Nino makes it a little bit harder for hurricanes to form in the Atlantic. Basically, the wind conditions that happen in that part of the ocean are generally not as conducive to hurricanes when El Nino is there. But it only takes one big hurricane making landfall where people live to cause massive damage. And climate change has caused temperatures in the Atlantic to soar, which means there's more fuel for storms that do form. And none of that is anything that El Nino can fix. Plus, El Nino does nothing to temper storms that form in the Pacific Ocean. So it, again, is kind of limited good news.
Well, what about outside the U.S.? Like, what does El Nino do globally?
Globally, the big thing that it does is drive up average temperatures. And this goes back to what El Nino is. So it happens when trade winds over the ocean get weaker, and that lets huge amounts of warm water move within the Pacific. So the eastern Pacific gets warmer. There's extra heat. And that extra heat, it drives up average global temperatures ever so slightly. Now, human-caused climate change, like from burning oil and gas and coal, is driving up global temperatures a lot. And that means every single year there's a chance that global temperatures will set a new record. So the extra heat from El Nino is often like that little bump that a year needs to cross over into record-breaking territory.
So years with an active El Nino, they often break the record for the hottest year?
Yeah, exactly. And actually, the last few years are a really good example of this. So last year, 2025, there was no El Nino, and it was one of the three hottest years on record. But last time there was an active El Nino, in 2023 and 2024, both of those years broke records. So 2023 was by far the hottest year ever recorded on Earth. There were deadly heat waves that killed people all over the world. And then the very next year, it happened again, with El Nino still in effect. So we have some warning about these looming El Nino conditions that are shaping up for this summer. So it's time to prepare for that extra heat.
That's Rebecca Hersher from NPR's Climate Desk. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
North Carolina has one of the fastest growing populations in the country. And it's not hard to see why. The beaches, the mountains, all of the great restaurants in the Research Triangle, and plenty of ants. So it's no wonder that armadillos want to live there. These armored animals are slowly laying claim to the Tar Heel State. Our next guest says in a decade or so, they may live in all of the state's 100 counties. Colleen Olfenbuttle is the Game Mammals and Surveys Unit Supervisor with the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. I always get excited to talk about our newest resident in North Carolina.
I'm very interested in this because I'm like, armadillos in North Carolina? When did armadillos start showing up in my home state?
Yeah, well, I got the phone call in 2008 about a credible observation of an armadillo in a county in western North Carolina, and it has increased tremendously since that phone call.
So are there any indications like how they made this journey into the state?
Yeah, pretty much they did it on their four little legs. You know, we get a lot of jokes. We get a lot of jokes that, oh, these armadillos jumped off the back of a truck from Florida bringing palm trees to a nursery. But they did it on their own. You know, armadillos are well established in Tennessee, Georgia, South Carolina, Alabama. So it's just, we were proximate to an established population. And as those armadillo populations increased in those states, the surplus started wandering into our state.
So how are they affecting the environment in North Carolina?
Yeah, that's a question that I don't have an answer to, but there's evidence that maybe armadillos, just like beavers, are ecosystem engineers. And what we mean by that is, you know, here's an animal that can really change and modify the habitat, which might have actual benefits or detriments to other species. In the case with an armadillo, they build these burrows that can provide refuge for them. It provides a place they can have their young, a place they can shelter from weather, a place they can escape predators. And researchers in Arkansas determined that these burrows provided shelter, provided dens, provided resting areas, provided foraging opportunities, protection from weather and temperatures for a whole host of other species, which is why, in addition to the armadillo having all these other nicknames such as Hoover Hog, Texas Turkey, Little Armored One, Ecosystem Engineer might be yet another nickname for the armadillo.
I mean, and you're clearly monitoring this population in North Carolina. Do you think that there'll ever be a need to control the population of armadillos?
The answer is yes, but armadillos, they're hard to control. After armadillos have been through, it looks like miniature landmines have gone off. I mean, it's pretty extensive damage. So, you know, we do allow people to hunt armadillos year-round. They can be trapped during our regulated trapping season. And then outside that trapping season, we do allow our certified licensed wildlife control agents to issue depredation permits to take armadillos that are causing damage. But obviously, we aren't really controlling them because they've been expanding out of South America since at least the 1500s. and they continue to march onward. Just, they're so adaptable. You know, they're one of the most adaptable mammals we have in North and South America.
That's Colleen Olfenbuttle with the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission. Thank you for talking with me.
Thank you very much, Aisha. I really enjoyed it.
The children's TV show Yo Gabba Gabba premiered in 2007, and from the beginning, music was always at its heart.
There's a party in my tummy.
The show brought musicians on to sing their own versions of the Yo Gabba Gabba songbook, from Erykah Badu and My Chemical Romance to Anderson .Paak and, as you're hearing now, Silver Sun Pickups. The show's reboot, Yo Gabba Gabba Land, has just entered its second season, and we have its creators, Christian Jacobs and Scott Schultz, here to talk to us about the importance of music to the show's success. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Why was it important, particularly for kids, to have that fusion of the music and not just, although a lot of kids' music can be pretty good. Some of it's not so much. We don't want to name names, but some of it can be pretty good. So why did you want to have that fusion for kids?
Well, this is Christian. You know, being young fathers ourselves at the time, we remember Sesame Street and the shows we grew up watching, Electric Company and even Pee-wee's Playhouse and things like this, that where the music was such a strong component to the show. But we also were listening to music with our kids at home.
Turn the light on.
You know, whether it was L.A. disco from the 80s or early hip hop or even like Ramones and punk rock stuff. It was kind of those simple beats that really made our kids jump around and dance and have a dance party. And that was really the impetus to wanting to make a kids show, was really reacting to what our own kids were listening to with us at home and what they were responding to. It just didn't seem like at the time there was something filling that gap for our own kids.
And so now Chicano Batman joined you on the show.
Yes.
I think we have a clip of that. Sometimes turtles eat waffles. Like, what's the lesson of that song?
Yeah, this is Scott. I mean, I would say Yo Gabba Gabba, we just love absurd fun. Just absurdity and, like, having fun with our kids. I think experiencing life sometimes is all the learning you need.
Yeah, definitely. And one of our writers, Orinthia Carter, came in one day. She was wearing a shirt that said, "Sometimes turtles eat waffles," and it had a funny turtle eating a waffle, and it just made us all laugh, and it just was kind of the spirit of the show, you know, just fun and silly, and just a little reminder to our kids that, like turtles, we don't always have to eat the same things or do the same things as everybody else, and sometimes we can eat waffles or we can eat turtle salad or whatever it is.
And the original run had Weezer, Devo, The Roots, Bootsy Collins. Yo Gabba Gabba Land has already featured Thundercat and Portugal the Man. How do you decide? Or do you cast a wide net and just see who says yes?
Yeah, this is Scott. You know, for us, we were always trying to do something fun and silly and non-traditional for kids. So for us, we kind of cast a wide net, and really, we're not choosing people to be on the show based on their star factor. It's really who's there for the kids and who's having fun with us. That's kind of how we approach it, and it's been just magical the whole way through with bands.
You know, Thundercat, Portugal Man, everyone jumped at the chance to come hang out with us and play in the sandbox a little bit. And it really matters to the show and to the objective of the show. And that's, you know, to help kids and have fun and get them moving and also help them learn a little bit.
And here's a bit of the song, Thank You Is Enough. Was Santi Gold performing it from this season. Why did you want to get so many artists involved in the program rather than rely on some regulars?
Yeah, having these people on the show that have kids and they kind of really want to be there for the kids is really what we're here for. So that's the fun for us, is seeing kids having fun together with real music, dancing with their parents, with their brothers and sisters, just kind of experiencing life through music.
This is Christian. You know, we've got our main characters and our host, Cammy Cam, who do a great job singing songs and doing things themselves. So there's just so much music in every segment of the show. It's fun when we are able to have a Santi Gold or a Portugal the Man or a Thundercat show up. It just makes it even funner to dance with our main characters. So yeah, there's just tons of music going on all the time in the show because it's a musical. It really is.
When people think about children's entertainment, it's changed so much. I mean, even from 2007 to now, how does Yo Gabba Gabba Land approach that and think about that because the entertainment environment for children has changed so much?
Scott, you want to go first?
Yeah, I'll jump in. That's a great question. I think where we're at is it's less about trying to hold kids' attention and trying to distract them. And I think what GABA's offering is, hey, let's just take a time out and dance together. Listen to some music, be silly, play and experience life. And I feel like that's what GABA's offering.
Yeah, and if I could just jump in too, beyond the dancing and movement, we also want to introduce kids to the notion that you can go out there and find new things and learn new things on your own. But we want to inspire kids to explore, you know, and to learn new things and be excited about discovering new things and discovering new ways of dancing and having fun and have a good time and then maybe, you know, go find out a little bit more about the world. That's really what we want to do.
That's Christian Jacobs and Scott Schultz, the creators of Yo Gabba Gabba Land. It's now available on Apple TV Plus. Thanks so much for joining us.
All right, thank you.
Thanks for having us.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate at progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. From Cigna Healthcare. At Cigna Healthcare, they're dedicated to being there through life's everyday and extraordinary health moments. Learn more at cigna.com/better. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. We receive support from Bemidji Brewing, featuring seasonal beers this spring, including the Spring IPA, Lakeshore Lime Lager, and Foam Float IPA. Bemidji Beer, nice catch. The Grand Rapids chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness hosts a webinar Thursday, March 26 from noon to 1 p.m. Learn about a new judicial program in Itasca County called Mental Health Court. Find a registration link at NamiGrandRapidsMN.org. The Minnesota Discovery Center in Chisholm.